Welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm here with Stephanie and Tony and Jamie, and we're here to talk about Ready Player One. We're going to talk about the movie, the new movie that's just in theaters now, but we're also going to talk about the book. We've talked about it before, and it influenced the movie, obviously, so we'll get into that. But Ready Player One is a new movie by Steven Spielberg, based on the book by Ernest Cline, and it's about a dystopian future where people take refuge in the Oasis, which is a VR world. And people play games there, they meet there, they shop there, sometimes they go to school there. And it's about how the real world and this virtual world interact when all of a sudden the virtual world is up for grabs. So what do we think of the movie Ready Player One?
I really liked Ready Player One as a movie. I thought it was a surprising feat of taking something that is a book which seems unfilmable and turning it into something that flows from beginning to end. I mean, it definitely had a great introduction to the world. I think if I was first introduced to the story through the movie, I would be really, really hyped about it. But since I read the book first, you know, there were some things that left me a little bit wanting, and that's mainly because the movie is a specific medium that, like, they had to do big and flashy things to use the screen space and to capture our imagination. And it focused less on like the technicalities of what it is actually like to be a gamer in a virtual world and what that means to those gamers. Because I feel like maybe that experience is something that only someone that's played a lot of video games understands, and they had to make this appeal to a broader audience. So it didn't resonate with me as much as the book resonated with me in that regard.
So what kind of aspects about that gaming life do you feel like the book talked about that the movie glossed over? Because I'm not a gamer, so it's not immediately salient to me.
The video game like death mechanic is like called permadeath, and it's when you lose all your stuff in Ready Player One in the movie, you just explode and all your gold and items fall on the ground, and that makes sense. But they didn't mention anything about leveling up or gaining experience, which is like a kind of RPG element. And it's almost a one-to-one reflection of the time spent in a video game, you know, at least initially, is the level that you are. So the fact that you're losing that time is, in a sense, a real resource that humans have a finite amount of. So it makes death a little bit more permanent and a little bit more severe. So the fact that they lacked that and they didn't really even talk about leveling up and, like, you know, in order to leave the starting planet, you needed to be a certain level. Otherwise, things would just kill you in the book. So, yeah, I think the world opening up or being limited to just this starting planet or starting world wasn't even like a consideration in the movie. So it made death seem, and it made people's avatars and their characters seem a little less important and more replaceable, if that makes sense.
I think that's really interesting, especially since a lot of what we see in the movie is this divide between the haves and the have-nots, or that giant corporation where they can employ tons of people and who can just play this game all the time versus, you know, people like Parsifal who are, you know, just like in this like 20-level trailer type situation. And the people who have not just the disposable income but disposable time and like that time investment. So I think that's interesting. I didn't think about that when I saw the movie.
I really enjoyed it as a standalone. That I thought that having read the book several times, I felt that it really captured the characters very well. I felt like I knew each of them individually based on their characters from the story, but was disappointed to find that a lot of the building that you're talking about, the moving from place to place, he's not, he can't even, in the story, he can't even go from his planet where he is stranded at school to other places. And the leveling up part about being able to gain those experience points and things like that. And you are correct. None of that is addressed in the film at all. I hadn't really considered that point because I am also not a gamer. But I think it's an important difference to consider between the two. And now I'm giving that some more thought.
And where it lacks in like gaming references, it makes up for in movie references. And I think like it's rich in movie references. I don't know if there's any particular ones. I think The Shining comes to mind, which is like a really unique scene.
But. Or just like, so the first quest or mission or challenge or whatever they call them in the movie is the race. And the race is studded with King Kong and the T-Rex from Jurassic Park and the car from the DeLorean. So it kind of defines that this is going to be a movie about references. And I think that's a great way to do it. And it's a very exciting, very visual way to represent a challenge on screen. as we were talking about, the Tomb of Horrors is the original.
Yeah.
The original challenge, first challenge.
Maybe, for the Copper Key.
Yeah, maybe not so exciting a visual as a big race through, what, Manhattan towards Central Park when you're being chased by dinosaurs and dodging barriers and
saw blades.
And all those strange things popping up and popping out of the sides. I enjoyed the movie very much, which I'm excited to say out loud because I have a history with this book. I did not like this book. I podcasted about how I didn't like this book. The movie didn't engage me so strongly from the beginning, but the longer and longer it went on, the more and more I got into this movie. By the end, I was sitting up, edge of my seat, eyes wide open, taking in everything, really invested in the characters. Like, even though I kind of know how it ends because I read the book, like, I'm still invested in this movie. I'm still, you know, emotionally engaged in what's going on screen.
Yeah.
And maybe that's Spielberg for you, but, you know, he made a good movie.
He did. Some of the references are out of time, though, which is interesting. Tony, before we started talking, mentioned the soundtrack, and we pointed out that some of the songs from the soundtrack are actually not 80s based. In discussion with someone else, this was not something that I was familiar with before, but they helped me out, the name of the giant monster.
Iron Giant.
Which in the book is not the same, correct?
Right.
And that actually was a product of the 90s.
Yes.
So there were just a few elements that were a little disappointing for those of us who know the difference. That was not one of my differences, but, the people that I saw it with recognized that immediately.
Yeah, maybe he wanted a little bit wider audience than just the 80s, pulling some 90s kids. There's a Ninja Turtle at one point, I think. There were Master Chiefs from Halo, you know. And then even
Tracer from Overwatch.
Tracer from Overwatch, which is from last year, two years ago.
The group that I saw it with suspected that there might have been an issue of licensing.
Yes, I'm sure there was.
You think that might have been part of the reason.
But these are just the things that they were able to, to grab. And I think that didn't jar me specifically, even though like things like the Iron Giant I knew were not specifically from that era, because it would have existed, you know, at the time that the movie exists, you know, an older, like more vintage thing anyway. So even though it wasn't specific to like that 80s era that's kind of immortalized in the film, it didn't pull me out the way that sometimes things do when it's supposed to take place in the 80s. And then something that happens in the 90s is there and you're like, oh, that's like a jarring disconnect. And I didn't feel like exactly the same way.
Well, it's a virtual world anyway.
Yeah,
it's
so,
not
like,
real time.
So it didn't like necessarily have that same thing.
I did have one jarring disconnect.
Did you?
Do have to take issue with the Holy Hand Grenade. Appears in the film, which is from Monty Python. He buys it and uses it. There's a lot of references to other movies and other games and other things like that. And like there's these magic items in the world. And he has the Holy Hand Grenade and he pulls the pin and he throws it and it explodes. He never counts. You have to count. That's the whole joke from the movie. His three is the number of the counting and the number of the counting shall be three. Five is right out. So, like, for a movie about references, they got a lot of them right. But that one, like, I think I scoffed out loud in the theater. You have to count first. All you had to do is count to three. Anyway, that's my one beef with the movie is he didn't count to three before throwing the Holy Hand Grenade. But, you know, the rest of it was, you know, there were themes from, like, musical themes from, I think, Back to the Future and Spielberg themes. Like that was clever woven in. I liked the kind of exploding into coins. Scott Pilgrim did it too.
Visually, like, that was beautiful.
That was. I liked a scene towards the end when coins are just pouring out of a character and he's clearly distressed. That was great.
Bleeding.
Yes, bleeding
coins. Bleeding coins.
I will even say that what was maybe like a slight reference to the 80s was just the way that the Nolan Sorrento, big CEO guy, reminded me of the 80s, the trope of the 80s principal. Know, because he was just so easy to beat and that he had his like password written there. And he had this big fancy chair and he did all these things to like make himself appear. But, like his in-game avatar was like this big tough guy. And it's just like, it was great. It was like they took the ideas behind those like the bad principal or whatever.
Yeah, he looks like the principal from The Breakfast
from
Club.
The exactly.
Slightly taller, but it looks just like him.
Yep.
And I loved everything IOI. I loved the set design. I loved the characters. Just that room with all of those stations for all those people to be hooked up. the loyalty centers or whatever mm-hmm. were, you know, bleak and distressing.
Yeah.
And, you know,
there's tiny cubicles that Artemis is stuck in.
Yeah.
And, like, locked into. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All of that set design was great. The stacks where Wade lives at the beginning of the movie mm-hmm. were a set. Like, you know, that's amazing. If you see behind-the-scenes footage, you see Spielberg and Ernest Cline just walking around between the stacks. Mm-hmm. The opening shot of the movie where Wade is descending his stack mm-hmm. and he's going to his secret hangout where mm-hmm. he has his equipment. But you see all these people doing ludicrous things because they're all logged into the Oasis and, like, some are surfing and some are playing piano. Like, that was a Spielberg shot to begin the movie. It establishes the tone. It mm-hmm. establishes the theme. It establishes, you know, what to expect.
And how bleak it is.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bleak future mm-hmm. in 2043.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People bleak. Living in trailers. If you haven't read the book or seen the cover, it's like RVs just came to Columbus and there's nowhere to go, so they just started stacking them. So there's stacks.
That's like, actually interesting, too, because they said it in the Midwest, but actually Wade lives in Oklahoma in the beginning of the book.
I forgot that.
Yep. Halliday's actually from Middletown, Ohio, which is near my hometown of Dayton. Yeah, also bleak.
Dave, I was interested in... So what were the things that you hated about the book, and how come that didn't translate over into hatred of the movie?
Like, so what I didn't like about the book was that it is the hero's journey,
mm-hmm.
and it is pure and perfect as the Wikipedia article is about the hero's journey. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Star Wars is also the mm-hmm. hero's journey, and I love Star Wars very much, so I don't necessarily hate the hero's journey. What bothered me was Star Wars took the hero's journey and layered a bunch of new ideas on top of it. The book took the hero's journey and layered a bunch of nostalgia on top of it, and that was not a new idea.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like War Games is not a new idea to me. When he's, you know, playing through the second challenge or whatever, and he has to quote all the lines from War mm-hmm. Games. And that didn't appeal to me. Like, I was looking for something new. Like, in the book, when he goes into the Loyalty Center, I saw it coming. It's Belly of the Beast. It's, you know, step for step,
mm-hmm.
what you do in the hero's journey. Now, I get a little heated talking about the book. I really don't mean to be that intense about it. It was Ernest Cline's first book. It's a phenomenal work mm-hmm. for a first book, absolutely. It works for a lot of people. It just didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the movie is a little bit different because I think it, for one, it played off expectations of the book. Like, certain things that happen in the book happen backwards. Different characters do different things. I didn't see that coming, and mm-hmm. that got exciting, and that got weird, because then I'm like, how is this going to play out? How is that going to play out?
Mm-hmm.
Also, the movie, it's a little different. It's less about Parzival as a Mary Sue and more about the group coming together to solve a problem,
mm-hmm.
and I like that very mm-hmm. much. Whereas in the book, it's like anything you threw at Parzival, he's like, I know I can play a perfect game of Pac-Man. Of course I can. It's like no one can play. Even the people who have played a perfect game of Pac-Man can't play a perfect game of Pac-Man, like, on demand,
yeah.
in
mm-hmm.
the moment. Like, mm-hmm. it takes like 18 hours or something like that. It's absurd.
Yeah.
And then the movie skips some of those things. In Adventure, you know, the adventure part of the movie, that's believable that someone would know how to beat the game Adventure,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to playing a perfect game of Pac-Man,
mm-hmm.
which is enormously difficult. This was a question of knowledge rather than skill. And so
mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, I can believe that when they get to the Adventure challenge that Parzival knows what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So there was just an emotional component of these characters that in a two-hour movie just really hit hard. The mm-hmm. dance at mm-hmm. the club, I remember from the book, and they have it also in the movie. And in the movie, either it was the acting or the script, like, really got to me.
Mm-hmm.
More so than it did in the book. In the book, I kind of like, yeah, I kind of expected this would be the next action. But in the movie, when they come together and then they separate, it really hit me. And from that moment on, like, I was into the movie.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was a chance. I saw the movie in real 3D, I think it was, so I don't see many movies like that. But that dance was like one of the scenes where they blew things up and made them, like, it's not just a dance, it's floating in space, and it's a rave where you can mm-hmm. do disco in the sky mm-hmm. and there's lights everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of opens up your perspective of what's possible, even as a... I like how they would flash in between you know, Parzival in his VR suit.
Yes.
And, and, you know, because it shows that there's a real person behind this.
Mm-hmm.
And, it,
right.
and it showed that dual nature of being in a game, but that experience meaning something, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I thought it did a really good job of, like, in the game world, just, like, showing that this is, it's cool and it's flashy, but it's also personal and there's, like, this connection going on.
Mm-hmm.
I also really thought it was funny how Artemis and Parzival shared the whole, like, anime face thing, where mm-hmm. it was, like, not every character had an anime face, but they
yeah,
did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those eyes.
So, yeah,
those
that was
like just
eyes,
a little too
yeah.
big, yeah.
That's kind of a great visual.
Yeah.
That,
mm-hmm.
like, the second you see those two, you're like, oh, are those two going to get along?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because, you
they
know,
visually
they
match,
look like each
yeah.
other.
Yeah.
Shared features.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
absolutely.
Do you think there's anything, and I don't know the movie-making process from the
mm-hmm.
inside,
mm-hmm.
but the choice to have them meet in real life so early on in the
mm-hmm.
film,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the book, where they don't actually even see each other until the very end of the story.
Yes.
And I wondered how that, especially since you have such strong feelings about the difference, although I know you said that it's not the character issues necessarily, but
no.
yeah, do you have some thoughts about that?
I liked the idea in the movie that he's pulled into the resistance, as she calls it, because he was, in the book, Parzival is just a pure Halliday geek. He just loves Halliday. Everything
right.
he does, he loves. Everything he watched, everything he read, he loves.
He's a fanboy.
That's why, yeah, absolutely. That's why he's in the contest. In the movie, at the beginning, he's kind of like, oh, I want to win all this money and
mm-hmm.
move out. And then, like, that's a weak answer to
mm-hmm.
give. And so giving him a sense of purpose, she gave him her sense of purpose. And he saw that, oh, this is about more than just me
mm-hmm.
and getting a $1 trillion or whatever
mm-hmm,
it is,
mm-hmm.
this could be about people and this is about relationships and this
fixing
is about so
what's
much.
Broken in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
And so having them meet up in the movie gave him a character arc that he didn't have in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a good decision.
Yeah.
It's a strange decision because it departs from
wildly.
The book.
Yeah.
It does. But then again, if it had been beat for beat recreation of the book, I would have been bored. And I really liked this movie, it turns out. So.
And I really liked the movie too, which was a surprise to me,
mm-hmm.
considering that those who know me usually say that what I really want out of a book to movie conversion is the 12-hour BBC version, where it actually has every line of
yeah.
dialogue and
sure.
it is word for word. That doesn't bore me at all. I actually really enjoy that. But I thought the movie was kind of spectacular.
Yeah, I very much more enjoyed. I didn't hate the book. I didn't love the book, but I liked the movie a lot more than
mm-hmm.
I had in the book. And I think part of that is because I am not entrenched in this gaming world or in the world of, like, I haven't seen a bunch of those movies that came out in the 80s. But even if I don't know the references explicitly, like, visually, I can still recognize them more. So I think as, like, a very casual lay consumer,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
the movie was much more accessible to me as a watcher than the book maybe was.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I didn't know this, but when I sat in the theater, I had the special seat that rumbled every time.
Oh my God. The D-Box.
Yeah, the D-Box. I did not know I was sitting in D-Box. I was supposed to pay an extra $8, and I didn't. I just thought it was a seat. And so every time something got shot or moved or exploded, my seat would explode, and I felt like I was in there.
Yeah.
In this, you know, like this virtual reality. So it went along with the theme.
An extra added layer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what was interesting to me when watching the movie, too, is how they portrayed this virtual world alongside you. Tony, you were talking about that, alongside the real world consequences of that. And I think as we get more into augmented reality and virtual reality in our regular lives, like
mm-hmm.
a lot of movies that aren't fantasy or science fiction are going to have to kind of depict that
mm-hmm.
in just regular, you know, everyday life movies because it'll be so entrenched in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really interesting to see, like, how going forward movies will do that. Kind of how they, when people text each other on TV and stuff, they kind of like have the bubbles floating
sure.
on the screen.
I think technically, like, kind of going off of the point of VR and how with technology we are almost at the point where a lot of these technologies are really in their experimental
mm-hmm.
phases or like consumer phases. And I just loved how they ended up creating, well, number one, the almost like action flashbacks of Halliday and his
Ogden.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Ogden. Thank you, Ogden Morrow. and how great, like, they could go and scrutinize that. But then also, like, you know, the haptic suit, or versus, like, when they were in the van and they had, you know, Parzival tied up into this, like, rig.
And he's floating around.
And he's floating around. Yes. And it's just, like, how cool it is to see those practical effects and, like, just kind of imagine what it'd be like to rig that up, like, in your basement or something, you know?
That was pretty great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that future is so close to us, you know.
Oculus Go is out now. Mm-hmm. Like, it just came out a week or two ago.
What is that?
I don't know what that is. So the Oculus Rift is a VR headset and controllers, but you need a pretty sturdy computer to run it. But the Oculus Go does not require a computer. It's a standalone thing. It's just you put a visor on. It's a couple $100s. You don't need to be tethered to a box.
So there could be hundreds of teenagers just running around all the time. You know, dangerous.
Parts,
but it's on.
Goodness.
Well, and things like they're trying the Pokemon Go Fest in, like, downtown Chicago again this year.
Whereas last year
it was like a horrible
disaster. How are they going to be able to – are they just trying to boost everything up so that they have enough to be able to handle all those people?
Maybe they're hoping it's not as big of a fad now and there's fewer people. But I'm sure there's still be as
many
people.
I can't even make a phone call at Lollapalooza.
But it goes to show, you know, like, sometimes these virtual things will have real-world consequences. Yeah. And in this case, it's a community of people that are interested in the same game experience. And it's powerful. You can travel to a different city, and there might be a contingent of Pokemon Go players walking around the downtown areas, you know. It just depends. I hear Seattle's really big still.
Sure. For that, but. Sure. All right. Any final thoughts on Ready Player One? If you haven't read the book, come to the library. We got a lot of copies. Mm-hmm. You might have to place a hold, but we'll have it on DVD soon enough. But for now, check out the book. Any final thoughts, anyone?
And check out the soundtracks on Hoopla, because they're free for library card holders.
There you go.
Yeah.
Excellent. I can't wait to see it again.
I will watch it again. Maybe not tomorrow, but
like, sometime
when
soon.
When it comes out on DVD, I will watch it again.
Mm-hmm. I think I'd like to see it on the big screen again.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Yeah.
Visually, because it is so fantastic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks, everyone. That is the Pint and Click podcast. We'll see you next time.